Well, what does all that confusion that we just talked about, that we just read about, what does that have to do with Solomon? What are we talking about? Did you notice the mess that Paul seemed to make everywhere he went? Did you notice that it seemed like things were calm, and then Paul or his disciples showed up, the disciples of Christ, and everything gets into confusion? Did you notice that? And it seems like their answer to the confusion was to like yell. Did you notice? Verse 34 of chapter 19. But when they found out that he was a Jew, all with one voice cried out for about 2 hours, saying, "Great is Diana or Artemis of the Ephesians." You see, what's happening here in the book of Acts is people's worldview is being totally challenged and totally toppled sideways. Now, Luke gives us a picture of just how much it's being toppled here. You see, oftentimes we think that, and we're taught that all religions teach the same thing, and everybody believes that certain things are right and certain things are wrong, and it doesn't really matter who you worship. We all believe the same things. But Luke, writing here in the book of Acts, gives us a picture of what pagan theology looks like. And by the way, everybody has theology, right? Theos logos. God, theos God, logic, or logos, the logic of God. Everybody has some sort of logic of God, if you will. Even pagans. And the clerk, the city clerk in verse 35, calms them down by appealing to something that they knew for a fact was true. All right, and if you believe that all religions are the same, then listen to verse 35. And when the city clerk had quieted the crowd, he said, "Men of Ephesus, what man is there who does not know?" Solid knowledge here. Okay? I'm going to appeal to you of what we all know to be true right now. Look what everybody knows to be true. What man is there who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is temple guardian of the great goddess Diana or Artemis, and of the image which fell down from Zeus? And then just to put an exclamation point on it, therefore, since these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rashly. Do you see what he just appealed to? Excuse me. He just appealed to the idea, or the fact, if you will, that we all know that this city exists because this goddess fell down from Zeus, and here we are. Who could argue with that? And that's his point. Do you see how Paul coming in and preaching Jesus and the resurrection is not just like a slight little adjustment in your worldview? We're going this way, let's just turn a little bit. Not at all. Jesus Christ and the providential God challenges everything. And one of the points of the book of Acts is this is why we pulled out the passages that we did this morning. It appears as if every time God, the providential God, the overwhelming God who controls everything, the sovereign God, when he comes in, he just changes everything, and people get upset. It's not an easy little transition to make. And you see, he's a different God because he's a sovereign God over everything. You see, the idols, and we've been talking about this and seeing this in Ecclesiastes, the idols can be manipulated by men. That's the attraction of idolatry. You sacrifice your child, you give the idol money, and then the idol does what you want it to do. And Paul comes along throughout this entire book, and he's not the only one, Peter as well, comes along and presents a God that you cannot manipulate, that you cannot control, who is sovereign over every little thing. And that takes away your ability to control God. And that is the problem that we run into in the book of Acts. Now, let's see how that relates to us in Ecclesiastes this morning, chapter 3. We'll look at verses 3 through 15 this morning, a few observations about the passage, and then we're going to look at Solomon's problem, the challenges that Solomon is looking at. Our point this morning is that we can make no sense of the world outside of understanding a sovereign, providential God. Now, I need to emphasize providential God, because it wasn't that long ago, in our Christian circles, we would talk about God as providential, providing for us. We now talk about God as sovereign, but we don't talk about him as providential so much. That wasn't always the case. We even have a capital of one of our states in these 50 United States. One of our state capitals is even called Providence. Now, that particular state, Rhode Island, might not know, I mean, the residents might not understand where that name came from, but nevertheless, that the idea of a providential God was at one time part and parcel of our theology in talking about him. Now, why am I saying this? Well, Solomon is going to run into that sovereign providential God here this morning, and we're going to see it right in the passage. To everything, verse 1, there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to gain and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. What profit has the worker from the work in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before him. That which has already been and what is to be has already been, and God requires an account of what is past. Did you follow that? Can you make sense of what Solomon is saying here? He sounds rather passive here in verses 1 through 8, and he still sounds rather passive in verses 9 through 15. You see, up until now, it's been all Solomon. I work, I plan, I make, I do. What a horrible thing that after all my work, I'm going to pass it off to someone who may not be wise, who may not appreciate my work. And so then he goes into chapter 3 here, and for background information, Solomon's comments here, especially verses 1 through 8, get a lot of ink, mostly from non-believers. If you're speaking with a non-believer who knows a little bit about the Bible, they've probably heard at some point or another verses 1 through 8, at least parts of them. What do those verses teach us? What do we know as a result of studying these verses? Well, first of all, I'm going to use a term that we've used before, actually two terms. And the question that comes up when we study these verses is Solomon proscriptive here, or is he descriptive? In other words, is he describing reality here, or is he, proscribing what it's supposed to be like? In other words, would we know that there's a time to be born, verse 2, for example, there's a time to be born and a time to die, if Solomon didn't say it here? Well, I think the answer is pretty simple. We already know, and he's starting out, I think, by telling us the most basic item of all of his items that he discusses here, the most basic one being clearly. I mean, you might be able to argue it's a time to love and a time to hate. Might be able to argue a time for war and a time for peace. But I don't think you can argue a time to be born and a time to die. That is like really, really obvious. And that's the one that he starts out with. So I think he's telling us by how he starts out, he's being descriptive. He's describing reality here. He's not proscribing the way it's supposed to be. He's describing the way that it actually is. We see this actually in the New Testament. We won't turn to it. But John the Baptist did a similar thing with Herod. You'll remember that Herod had stolen his brother Philip's wife and was married to her and was getting away with it and would have gotten away with it except for one very godly, courageous prophet who was more concerned about telling Herod the right thing than he was about living, quite frankly. Yeah, that's right. That was John. He was more concerned about doing the right thing than he was about his own life. And he went and he told Herod, it's not lawful to have your brother's wife. Now, what was he saying there? He wasn't saying like, you know, Herod, there's some kind of law that we have in Roman law that you're not allowed to have your brother's wife. Not at all. He was saying, this is just out of bounds. You just can't do it. The reality is, Herod, there is no law that allows you to steal your brother's wife. That's the way it is. It's reality. I'm describing, John says, reality for you, Herod. Can't steal your brother's wife. Can't do it. I believe that's what's happening here in the sense that Solomon is just saying the way it is. I mean, how can you argue with this, especially in the beginning? A time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted, right? You would never plant unless you were ultimately going to harvest what you've planted. Basic things here. Moving on. A time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down, a time to build up. Here's where we run into a few problems, is it not? A time to kill. Is there ever a time to kill? Well, you might say animals got to eat. But I don't think we're talking about animals here. We're talking about something more. We're talking about people. Really, a time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down, a time to build up. Here's a question for you as we study this morning. Is there ever a time when killing a human being will actually bring healing? Can that ever happen? The answer to that is certainly yes, right? Question for you this morning. Are there people, this is tough stuff we're talking about here, but we need to talk about it. Solomon's describing reality for us here. Are there people in this world who need to be killed? Should be an easy answer. Really should be. You know, one of the most horrible things that we see happening more and more is these attacks becoming legalized, quite frankly, against children. Children being kidnapped, children being abused, and so forth. And what do we do about that? Well, we take people and we put them in jail. Well, congratulations. You know what? This is the amazing thing about the scriptures. The scriptures actually give us reasons for capital punishment, and the scriptures' reasons aren't that many. You know, you hear some people talk, oh, yeah, we live the Old Testament, everybody be dead. Not true. First of all, there weren't that many capital offenses in the Old Testament, maybe about 20 at the very most. Secondly, you could never put someone to death on one witness only. Now, is that true in our judicial system? I want to tell you something. If you study this in our judicial system, you can put people to death on no witnesses whatsoever. You can do that. It's been done. Circumstantial evidence, they call it. No witnesses. It was very difficult under Moses to put someone to death. You had to have at least two witnesses. And Moses was very specific. You couldn't put someone to death on just one witness. I'm spending a little bit of time on this because I want to defend Moses and, shall we say, the Old Testament from this charge that we get, even from Christian circles, that somehow the Bible is unjust. And it's amazing to me when people come back at the Christians and say, well, you believe in capital punishment. Let me tell you something, my friends. Everybody believes in capital punishment at some level. Everyone. There's no one that doesn't believe it. And we have people now that want to tell us that the Bible is unjust. But they're okay with capitally punishing 60 million babies. Yeah, 60 million babies have been capitally punished. You know what their crime is? Their crime is existing. That's the crime for which they're put to death. So as we read this, let's understand that capital punishment is not just a Christian idea. It's an idea that's everywhere. The only question is for what reason? You see, under the Bible way, capital punishment exists for the guilty. But when you're talking about 60 million babies, and now you believe in capital punishment for the innocent, do you not? Moving on. A time to weep and a time to laugh, of course. A time to mourn and a time to dance. Time to dance. All right, next verse, quick. A time to cast away stones. Let's talk about that dancing thing for just a minute here. Yeah, we don't have Baptist in our official church name. We're the Independence Reformed Bible Church, not the Independence Reformed Baptist Church. So we're allowed to have an opinion on dancing around here. Here's the thing. When we read dancing in the Bible, I challenge you to do this. It's easy to do. When you look up dancing, it's almost always a good thing. Like we see it here, a time to mourn and a time to dance. It's presented as a good thing here. From Psalms, you've turned my mourning into dancing. I still remember the first time I saw this kind of acted out. I had come from a background where dancing was just always wrong. Any kind of dancing was just right up there with playing cards and other heinous smoking, perhaps other heinous crimes. Yes, sir. As I hope by the grace of God, I developed my Christian life. I remember thinking about this. Wait a minute, we've come up with all these sins, playing cards, going inside a movie theater, playing pool for Pete's sake. I never did figure that one out. And we had all these lists of sins, right? And I remember thinking at some point, oh my word, don't I have enough problem with sins, with pride, with lust, with coveting my neighbor's goods, with hatred? Don't I have enough problems? Why am I adding playing cards to this? I mean, I think for the rest of my life, it's going to be a war against all these sins that I have inside of me now. What in the world do I think? I've conquered all my lust, pride, hatred problems and sins, and now I've got to concentrate on playing cards for Pete's sake? Are you kidding me? And, of course, dancing lines up right there in the middle of the whole mess, does it not? But if you look up dancing, the only time I see it as a bad thing is when we had a lustful dance going on when Herod's illicit wife's daughter came and danced for Herod. The rest of the time, I see it as a good thing in the scriptures. And I remember seeing that with the India Children's Choir. Anybody here ever see the India Children's Choir? Some of you have. They do a routine called "You've Turned My Mourning into Dancing," and what they do is they dance, and these kids do this, and it was one of the most powerful presentations of the gospel that I'd ever seen, and it was shown through dancing. And here's what they did: they turned the lights down, and they in the darkness, someone says something like, many years ago, our grandparents were headhunters. And they come from a tribe of former headhunters. They would attack their enemies and cut off their heads. And that's what they did just a few generations ago. And then as the lights come up, they say that, but then the missionaries came and brought us the gospel of Jesus Christ, right? And these kids, I don't even know what it's called, but they have these like bamboo sticks, right? And these little boys, and they're smacking them down on the ground, right? And they're going like a boom, boom, chick, boom, boom, chick, like that, right? And the girls are jumping in and out of the bamboo sticks. And they're singing, it's so powerful. They're singing, "You've turned my morning into dancing." And that's what it was for them. You live among headhunters. You fear for your life every single day. And all you have is sadness and despair. And it was Christ who actually turned that around. And we had a description that day and an actual physical, shall we say, example. "You've turned my morning into dancing." Dancing. There's bad dancing, yes there is. But there's good dancing. I hope you get a chance to participate in good, godly dancing. All right, moving on. That's why we have a question time afterwards, right? A time to cast away stones, verse 5, and a time to gather stones. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. Talk about that just really briefly. Time to embrace and time to refrain from embracing. Some people are huggers. I don't know exactly how all that works. And I can't give you the moral dimensions of every single hug that's ever taken place. All I know is not all I know, but for me personally, I really like to hug pretty much one person. That's Mrs. Saint. Pretty much all the other hugging for me is kind of nervy and kind of hard to do and awkward for me. I know my own father was like really down on hugging. He was like, "Shouldn't do it." Other people I've known are huggers. I can't tell you, like I say, the moral dimensions of every single hug ever. But I can say that Solomon gets it here. There's a definite time to refrain from hugging, embracing, if you will. Like I say, I can't tell you everything about that, but every one of us should have, we actually should have a theology of hugging. We should. Because there's a time to refrain from it. And we should know what time that is. At least for us. Maybe I've gone too far the other way. Not a hugger. It's just awkward. Just hug. How tight? Do you smack the other person in the back when you hug or not? There's a lot to hugging. I guess I've just never learned. But there is a time to do it. Solomon clearly says, and there's a time not to do it. Verse 6, a time to gain, a time to lose, a time to keep, a time to throw away. Again, nothing here we can possibly argue with. A time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak. Isn't that what we struggle with? A time to keep silence, a time to speak. And we hear when we're being taught, "Hey, ask any questions, there's no dumb questions." When you hear someone say there's no dumb questions, do not believe that. Do not believe that. People will judge you based on the questions you ask. There are dumb questions. Don't ask them. A time to keep silence, a time to speak. Yeah. Think about it before you speak up. That's a time to tear and a time to sow. It's an interesting comment there. Remember when, and this wasn't the only time, do you remember when the law of God was discovered under Josiah? And they were so completely apostate. They were so apostate, they had buried God's law. And they actually discovered it when they were trying to clean out the temple. They found the law of God. This was the law that every king was supposed to have his own handwritten copy of. Understand that. In other words, what Moses had said is whoever the king is has to have his own handwritten copy. It couldn't be like, "Hey, the king before me wrote this out. I'll just use his copy." Not good enough. He had to have his own copy. And that's why he was buried so deeply, and they find it. And Josiah, remember what he does first? He tears his clothes. And this was something that they did in the Old Testament from time to time when something horrible, horrific. And it was they would tear their clothes when they realized that there was a judgment of God coming on this place. And that's what Josiah realized right away. Great, look at what we've done. God's judgment is great on us. Now, this is something that I wish I had an answer for, and I don't. I don't know how the sackcloth and ashes thing works now. I don't know how the tearing of clothes works. And so right now you're kind of getting a picture into my head here. We are under God's judgment now. We're being judged now. We can't talk necessarily of God's judgment coming on us if we don't repent. It's here now. Excuse me. Do we publicly tear our clothes? Do we publicly get some ashes and some burlap sacks and sit down on a hill someplace and weep and mourn for the great wickedness that occurs in this country every day? I don't know the answer to that. It's something I've studied. I've not seen even in the revivals of the past that kind of behavior. So I don't really know. And I don't think that Solomon here is just talking about repentance here when he says a time to tear and a time to sow. So I don't really know. I'm just throwing it out there this morning for us to think about, for all of us to think about. We live in a nation that has experienced the grace of God tremendously. Have we not? I mean, we have experienced God's grace more so than most, by far. And what have we done with it? We've turned our back. And we have our fists in God's face. And we're under his judgment now. And he's being gracious to us now, even in judgment. Is he not, my friends? Is he not being gracious to us even now? Is he not judging us like he could judge us? His grace is tremendous to us. And what are we doing with that grace? I don't know the answer to the sackcloth and ashes question. I will tell you that it's been something that I've been probably thinking about probably for years. But I do know this. According to Solomon here, there is a time to tear one's clothes as a public display of the recognition of the just punishment that we deserve. Excuse me, that we deserve for our trashing of God and his word. Moving on. A time to love, a time to hate, a time of war, a time of peace. A time to love and a time to hate. You know, our tolerance police should read this verse. They come out and they say they don't hate anyone, they tolerate everyone. Now, I don't hate. Well, that's easy to say. You know, that's one of the things we like about the Bible. It's just like right out there. And here Solomon's saying, listen, can we be honest? There is a definite time to hate. And it's not that hard to think of what we are to hate. We read last week from Psalm 139, David saying, do not I hate them that hate you. I count them my enemies. Do we not hate those who destroy their neighbor, for example? If you turn to Proverbs chapter 16, where it says, these six things does the Lord hate. Yeah, God hates certain things. And I don't think that we have permission to love what he hates at any point in our at all. No permission there. Our job is to find out what God hates and hate what he hates and love what he loves. Time of war and a time of peace. We've talked about that before here as well. And we don't have time to talk about the Swiss, who were always ready for war and have been at peace, and actually been at peace through a couple of world wars. The Swiss, who were always ready for war, whose young men are armed and who train and are able to defend their country. And you got to think about the Swiss sometime. You think about this war thing and peace. You got to think about them. How is it? How is it that the Swiss, a historically Christian country, how is it that the Swiss could be at peace in the middle, think about this, of three warring nations? Think about it. You know where Switzerland is? It's set in the middle of Italy, or in the center of Italy, France, and Germany. Think about that for a second. Anybody remember who some of the main belligerents were in World War II? Let's see. I think three of them were Italy, France, and Germany. And the Swiss maintained peace in the middle of that, in the geographical center of that. Do you know why they were so peaceful? Because they were ready for war. Documents discovered after the war found out that both agreed, both the Germans and the Swiss, and Hitler hated the Swiss. He hated the Swiss because they were the one German group, hated them, that didn't want to be under his authority. He had cowed the Austrians, but he couldn't scare the Swiss. And both sides agreed that it would just cost way too much. I'm going to tell you something. If I were taking over Europe, you know what country I want first? I'd want the one with the money. I'd want the one with the gold. Well, that would be the Swiss. And they managed to stay peaceful. They understood, I think, this. There is a time for peace and a time for war. And if you're ready for war, then you'll have peace, as they did. Well, Solomon here describing, not proscribing, describing the way things really are. But then he goes on to another part of it here. And he seems to get all like Solomon the depressed again. But the light is going to come through even more brightly than it has before. What profit has a worker from that which in which he labors? Now, let's talk about this for a little bit. Solomon is using a word here that, that is only used in the book of Ecclesiastes. It's a Hebrew word that has to do with labor and the type of labor that you can't get away from. And he's used before, what profit has a person as a labor and all his man has and all his labor that he labors under the sun. And in verse in verses 9 and 10, he's talking about that labor. I've seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. And it just sounds like he's not really in favor of all this work. Let's talk about where he uses this term. Chapter 1 and verse 13, I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven, this burdensome task. There's that word that God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised. In chapter 2 and verse 23, for all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night his heart takes no rest. 2:26, which we read last week. For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight, but to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting that he may give to him who is good before God. That word gathering and collecting, that's that same Hebrew word there for that labor, for that burden. And then chapter verse 10, I have seen the God-given task, that burden again. What is Solomon saying here? Well, I want to sort of see if I can get in perspective what he says here in verses 1 through 8, which we just read. Okay, because if we go to verse 26, we have that for God gives wisdom and knowledge to a man who is good in his sight, but to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting. The King James will say travail there. Travail is a good word. It means labor, right? It's used of a woman having a child. And if there's ever a proper term in the world for labor, at least as I see it from the outside, it's when a woman has a baby. It just like looks like nothing but labor to me. Travail, difficult work. And when that baby comes, you can't get out of it, right? You can't say, oh, I want to take a time out and let's put off this baby for a week or two. When the baby's coming, it's coming. You can't get away from the work. Now, he says this in verse 26. He uses that word travail or labor. And The sinner gives the work of gathering and collecting, verse 26. And then we see the same word in verse 10. I've seen the God-given task which the sons of men are to be occupied. So in between his use of that word, he describes for us what the world is like. But it looks like, in chapter 3, verses 1 through 8, he still hasn't gotten anywhere. He's still trying to figure it out. And he finally figures it out, it seems to me, in verses 12 through 15. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Now, we talked about that last week. We're going to talk about it a little bit more. How can we say that a man who labors, that's actually the gift of God? How can we say that? Isn't it his own gift to himself? Let's read it again. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Now, what is it there? What is the gift of God? Is it his labor? Or is it the fruit of his labor? What is it? And I think what Solomon's saying is it's all God's gift. It's a gift to God that we can even work. And it's a gift from God that we can enjoy the fruit of our labor. Now, some of you might get a little discouraged with me, because from time to time, I will discuss the socialists. And since we're talking about hating, I'll say publicly now that I hate socialism and socialists. Let's not make that mistake. Why is that? Well, in part because Solomon makes a very grand statement here. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and do good in their lives. Also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. And the socialists come along and say, it's really good for someone else to enjoy the fruit of his labor. And that's not what Solomon says here. He's very pointed on this, and we need to pay attention to this, because this is the part in Solomon's journey there where he's starting to turn things around. He's starting to see that it's not all about him, that the very fact that he's been able to labor and he's been able to do all these good things is not because of him. It's because of God's goodness toward him. God is giving him a gift. And to say that one person has a legal right to the labor of another is to attack the gift of God. Did you hear what I said? To say that one person has a legal right to the labor of another is to attack the gift of God, because the gift of God says that it's right for a man to enjoy his labor. Moving on. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before him. Do you see Solomon here running into a providential, sovereign God? Solomon's getting his perspective changed here. And it's not because we've had a nice little counseling session with Solomon. Solomon, it's going to be okay. Solomon, we know that, you know, when you turn all over your labor and all your money and all your wisdom over to someone else, it's going to be okay. It's all going to work out. That's actually not what happened. Next week, we'll look at what really did happen. Everything that Solomon feared in chapter 2 happened to him. When things went over to that goof-up Rehoboam, his son, who was everything opposite of Solomon, everything happened that Solomon worried about happened, the whole thing. So the answer isn't to pat people on the head and say, it's going to be okay. Not at all. The answer is a sovereign God who knows what he's doing. Look what he says. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, and nothing taken from it. And then he goes on to make a comment that is kind of scary. But I think he's saying, in case you didn't get the point here, this sovereign providential God, That which is has already been, and that which is to be has already been. There's a God who controls history. He controls everything. And God requires an account of what has passed. See, normally when we think of God being sovereign, we think of the future, maybe the present. Psalm is saying not in the future, in the present. He's also sovereign in the past. You see, what Solomon is running into is what we need to preach and what we need to tell people about. We have this tendency, shall we say, when people say, what shall I do and what am I doing and the world's going south on me and my world is upside down and I don't like living and things are difficult. What's our answer? I think our answer is right here. I think it's Solomon's answer. Do you understand? Do you trust? Do you really trust this God? See those folks we read about in the book of Acts? They had to switch their trust. They had to switch from trusting themselves to trusting the God that Solomon is presenting here and the God that Paul was presenting. I don't know where you are this morning. Things often don't work out the way you want them to. Do you believe and trust in the God of the Bible, the God who knows what he's doing? Do you believe in that God? Or do you believe in some sort of a God where if you just, I don't know, act a little better, then maybe he'll like act a little better towards you? No, we obey God. We don't obey God because so he'll do stuff for us. We obey him because he's worthy to be obeyed, and we don't have a choice, my friends. No choices there. He is a sovereign, great God. And Solomon doesn't have really answers here for what's going to happen in the future. But he does have the answer for who he's supposed to trust in the meantime. Shall we pray? Forgive us, O Lord, for our faithlessness. What evidence do we need that we should trust you, that you are trustworthy? What more evidence can we possibly look for? And yet you're gracious to us. You consider our frame, and you remember that we are dust. Thank you for that, O Lord. Thank you for remembering that. And may we trust you. Yes, as we look around, it seems like the world just kind of goes on and on and on. People live, people die. But yet behind it all, a sovereign God that we must trust in the meantime. May we understand what Solomon understood this morning. You are trustworthy. It's in Christ's name we pray it. Amen.